You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, September 23rd. I'm Grace from Drake University. Here is our first story. Lewis Central School Board approves association's legislative priorities by Tim Johnson. Written September 23rd. The Lewis Central Board of Education on Monday approved legislative priorities identified by the Iowa Association of School Boards. There was no discussion on the priorities. I think it's appropriate for Lewis Central to adopt these accordingly, Superintendent Eric Nost said. I wouldn't be able to put a finger on anything they've missed. The IASB supports the priorities below. Preschool. Supports continued funding to ensure that all 4 and 5-year-olds have access to the statewide voluntary preschool program. Supports an increase in funding from the current weighting of 0.5 to 1.0 full-time equivalent to increase the ability of districts to provide services such as full-day programming and transportation to ensure that all 4 and 5-year-olds have the ability to attend the statewide voluntary preschool program. Districts should be given the maximum flexibility to assign costs to the program. Mental health supports efforts to establish comprehensive community mental health systems to offer preventative and treatment services and comprehensive school mental health programs that include in-school and telehealth access for students to mental health professionals, creation of a categorical funding system stream designated for mental health professionals, reimbursement by Medicaid and private insurers for in-school services, ongoing teacher, administrator, and support staff training to improve the awareness and understanding of child emotional and mental health needs, integration of suicide prevention and coping skills into existing curriculum, expanding state-funded loan forgiveness programs to include mental health professionals who agree to provide services to schools, and an ongoing mental health resource clearinghouse for schools and community providers. School funding policy supports a school foundation formula that provides sufficient and timely funding to meet education goals, equalizes per-pupil funding, provides a funding mechanism for transportation costs that reduces the pressure on the general fund and addresses inequities between school districts. Includes factors based on changes in demographics, including socioeconomic status, remedial programming, and enrollment changes. Reflects actual costs for special education services. Incorporates categorical funding in the formula within 3 years and includes a mix of state aid and property taxes. Supplemental state aid. Supports setting supplemental state aid at a rate that sufficiently supports the local school district's efforts to plan, create, and sustain world-class schools. For FYI 2020 by January 31, 2020, and for FYI 22 and future budget years, at least 14 months prior to the certification of the school district's budgets. Setting supplemental state aid within the statutory requirements allows districts to make sound financial decisions on programs, staffing levels, and providing the best possible education to all students. IASB supports a formula-driven method for establishing the supplemental state aid growth rate if it is not set within the statutory requirements. The board unanimously approved the IASB priorities. Our next article is titled Iowa Congressional Delegation Calls for Extension of Farm Aid. It was written by James Q. Lynch for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau on September 23rd. A proposed continuing resolution from the U.S. House Democrats that excludes funding for farm assistance is drawing fire from the Iowa Congressional Delegation. A draft of the resolution to fund the federal government until December, unveiled by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Monday, does not include an extension of the borrowing authority of the Commodity Credit Corporation. If that happens, farm profitability and conservation payments and pandemic assistance for farmers could be delayed. So far, Iowa farmers have received about one-tenth or $1 billion of the nearly $10 billion paid out through the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. In a letter to Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, and Representative Steve King and Democratic Reps Abby Finneker, and Dave Lovesack, as well as Cindy Axne, wrote that Iowa farmers have not only suffered lost markets and disrupted supply chains from the COVID-19 pandemic, but they have also been dealing with drought conditions and the destruction caused by the recent derecho, which destroyed thousands of acres of crops. Separately, Finneker said Congress must replenish the CCC without delay, just as they must come together on a coronavirus relief package with additional aid for families, workers, first responders, and local governments. "It's great she signed onto the letter," said State Rep. Ashley Hinson, who is running against Finkenauer. "But she should have been screaming about this to her leadership for weeks because we knew this deadline was coming." Finkenauer filed an amendment Monday to extend the funding to ensure payments to farmers are not interrupted. "It's part of the political games Pelosi and Finkenauer are playing with farmer relief payments and derecho disaster aid," Hinson said. She suspects it's another example of Pelosi giving Democrats in vulnerable districts the opportunity to vote against leadership, while the Speaker knows she has enough votes to pass the continuing resolution. "That's why we need to debate again, so the Congresswoman can clarify her position on the issue," Hinson said. She and Finkenauer debated once, but the incumbent has not agreed to more debates. Our next article is called "Fisher Sass Mom on Supreme Court Vacancy: Grassley Earns Support Filling Seat Now," written by Joseph Morton for the World Herald Bureau on September 23, 2020. Republican senators refused to even consider President Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court in 2016 after Justice Antonin Scalia died that February. "It has not been the practice of the Senate to fill a Supreme Court vacancy that arises during an election year," Senator Deb Fisher, Republican from Nebraska, wrote a constituent at the time. Fisher wrote that she agreed with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, who cited that no election year confirmation argument in blocking Garland's nomination. "The American people should have a voice in this election," Fisher wrote, "but that was then and this is now." Despite the looming presidential election, McConnell plans to take up a nomination by President Donald Trump to fill the seat left vacant by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2016 and key in blocking Garland's consideration. Grassley, who is no longer the chairman, said in a statement Monday that the present circumstances are different from 2016 because Republicans now control both the White House and the Senate. "In this case, the people have spoken, putting power to appoint and confirm a nominee to the Supreme Court in one party," he said. "So make no mistake, if the shoe were on the other foot, Senate Democrats wouldn't hesitate to use their constitutional authority and anything else at their disposal to fill this seat." Democrats are blasting Republicans as hypocrites for their change of tune on election year nominations. Fisher has not said how she will treat Trump's nominee and did not respond to a World Herald interview request on Monday. Grassley still serves on the Judiciary Committee, along with Senators Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, and Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska. All three declined interview requests on Monday. Sasse hasn't said how he will treat the current vacancy, but it's worth noting that he took a different approach to the Garland nomination than many other Republicans. At that time, Sasse suggested that he would consider confirming someone nominated by Obama if the nominee stood in the Rose Garden and denounced what Sasse characterized as the president's flawed governing philosophy of executive unilateralism. Ernst, who is locked in a tough re-election fight, released a statement Monday. "Once the president puts forward his nominee for the Supreme Court, I will carry out my duty as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee to evaluate the nominee for our nation's highest court," she said. In 2016, Ernst supported refusing that evaluation for Garland. "In the midst of a critical election, the American people deserve to have a say in this important decision that will impact the course of our country for years to come," she said at that time. Ernst said it was not about any particular nominee, but rather giving the American people a voice. "We must wait to see what the people say this November, and then our next president will put forward a nominee," she said. Ernst's Democratic challenger, Teresa Greenfield, issued a statement over the weekend calling on the Senate to hold off. "Iowans are independent thinkers and voters, and we can all agree we certainly don't need more politicians in Washington who ignore what we think," she said. The next Supreme Court justice will have power over our access to healthcare, protections for pre-existing conditions, workers' rights, and the rules of our democracy for the rest of our lives. The only way to truly respect our independent voices in Iowa is by waiting to fill this seat until the next U.S. Senate and president we're about to vote for take office. Both parties have been rallying their most loyal supporters over the court vacancy and raising money off of it. Ernst garnered criticism for the speed with which her campaign sent a fundraising email after Ginsburg's death, which was announced on Friday evening. Ernst said later that the email should not have been sent and that while she hadn't seen it beforehand, she took responsibility for it. Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, sent a Ginsburg-related email encouraging people to donate to various Democratic candidates across the country, including Greenfield. The Greenfield campaign sent out its own email Saturday praising Ginsburg and urging people to get involved in the Senate race with a link to the campaign's website, which landed people on a fundraising appeal. But Greenfield campaign spokesman Sam Newton rejected comparisons to Ernst's email, noting that the Greenfield message itself did not include any mention of donations. Teresa sent a personal, heartfelt email about Justice Ginsburg, which clearly did not ask anyone to donate, he said in a statement. Our next article is titled Motorcyclist Dies from Injuries Suffered in Wreck on Veterans Memorial Highway. It was written by Mike Brownlee on September 23, 2020. A motorcyclist has died from injuries suffered in a wreck on Veterans Memorial Highway in Council Bluffs. The Council Bluffs Police Department confirmed Tuesday that the motorcyclist died Monday night. Police have not released the names of the two drivers involved in the wreck. The wreck occurred on Veterans Memorial Highway at the South 24th Street intersection on Friday night. Police said a preliminary investigation shows shortly before 7:40 p.m., a driver in a 2018 GMC Sierra 1500 pickup truck traveling eastbound on Veterans Memorial Highway turned in front of a motorcyclist on a 2017 Harley-Davidson driving westbound on the highway, causing the collision. Medics took the motorcyclist to an area hospital where the person later died. The truck driver was uninjured, police said in a release. Sergeant Ron Alvarez said Tuesday the department expects to release additional information on the case in the near future. Our next article is titled Lewis Central School Board Raises Limit on Compensation Members Can Receive. It was written by Tim Johnson on September 23, 2020. The Lewis Central Community School District Board of Education recently approved a change in the district's conflict of interest policy. The administration suggested making a change because the district's existing policy is more restrictive than Iowa law, and its attorney suggested aligning it more closely with the law. During its meeting Monday, board members acted to increase the amount of compensation board members or their spouses can receive for contracted goods or services from $2,500 to $6,000 per fiscal year. At its August 17th meeting, after a vigorous discussion, the board tabled its second reading for further review. Based on that discussion, Superintendent Eric Nost presented three options at Monday's meeting. Option 1. The school district can compensate a board member up to $6,000 per fiscal year for goods and services provided on a contract basis, if their selection is the result of competitive bidding. This is an increase from the previous limit of $2,500. Board members can be hired part-time or temporarily, but they are limited to $6,000 in compensation per fiscal year. Board members' spouses can be hired and receive unlimited compensation. This is the policy the board approved on the first reading. Option 1 is precisely what Iowa code reflects now, Nost said. Option 2 changes the limit from $2,500 to $6,000 compensation for contracted goods or services, as the first option does, but stipulates that neither board members nor their spouses can be paid employees of the district. Option 3 also changes the limit from $2,500 to $6,000 per fiscal year. It would allow board members and their spouses to be employed part-time or temporarily by the district, but would limit compensation to $6,000 per fiscal year. Board member Jennifer McDaniel said she favored option 1. After reading these again, I think the original option seems like the most reasonable, she said. I'm not sure why we are punishing spouses. The school district's current policy prohibits spouses from working full-time for the district, but Iowa law has been changed to allow spouses to work for board members' districts. During the board's discussion of the policy at a previous meeting, board member Travis Houston, or spelled H-O-U, S-E-T-O-N, said they should consider what the public perception would be. To me, I don't think this is the right time to change it, he said. Board President Doreen Schaefel, spelled S-C-H-E-F-F-E-L, said she was concerned that if board members were allowed to work part-time for the district and substitute teach, the teachers they substitute for might feel like they're being scrutinized. Board Vice President Daryl Weilich said he would not be comfortable with spouses being able to work for the district full-time. What happens if the district decides to terminate a spouse? I would not want to be a board member sitting in the room with everyone else knowing that your spouse is being terminated, he said. In addition, that situation could cause a board member to resign, leaving the board with an unanticipated vacancy to fill, said board member Amy Adkins. She said she would like to work for the district, but chooses to volunteer so she can still serve on the board. This position is important to me too, she said. Said McDaniel, I just feel like a spouse is a separate person. Board member Brian Stauffer cautioned against making district policy more restrictive than Iowa code. We have a lot of positions in our district we are unable to fill, and there are people who would like to do those things, he said. When it was time to vote, McDaniel moved that the board approve option one, and board member Bob Hendricks seconded it. The motion was defeated as McDaniel and Hendricks voted in favor, Stauffer abstained, and Weilich, Adkins, Houston, and Schaefel all voted against it. Then, Adkins moved that they approve option two, and Houston seconded it. The motion passed as Weilich, Adkins, Hendricks, Houston, and Schaefel voted in favor, McDaniel voted against, and Stauffer again abstained. In other business, the board set parameters for the sale of used tax revenue bonds to Piper Sandler at an interest rate not to exceed 3.5%. Our next article is called Man Attempts to Strangle Himself with Seatbelt in the Back of CBPD Cruiser. A Bellevue, Nebraska man attempted to strangle himself early Tuesday morning with a seatbelt while in custody of Council Bluffs police officers, the department announced through a news release. At about 1:38 a.m., officers made contact with 31-year-old Paul L. Pearson Jr. at Bucky's gas station, 2711 South 24th Street, who reportedly had active warrants out of Bellevue. After being taken into custody and placed in the back seat of a police cruiser, officers noticed movement and realized that Pearson was unable to get his handcuffs in front of his body and that he was able to wrap a seatbelt around his neck, police said. Officers were able to cut the seatbelt off of Pearson's neck, get him out of the cruiser, and placed on the ground. Council Bluffs Fire Department representatives subsequently arrived at the scene, placed Pearson in an ambulance, and transferred him to a local hospital for further evaluation. Pearson's condition wasn't provided by police representatives in the release. The article was written by Sam Pimper on September 23, 2020. This next article is called Risen Sun Christian Village Honors Employees for Pandemic Work, written by Mike Brownlee on September 23, 2020. Tuesday afternoon, leadership at Risen Sun Christian Village showed its appreciation to its staff for its work amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Everyone that's employed here has, in a lot of ways, put their personal lives, their work lives, on the line to take care of residents. Risen Sun Executive Director Matt Romshek, spelled R-O-M-S-H-E-K, said as outdoor festivities were winding down, "It's been very, very difficult. June and July were not good months here, but we've persevered here." The first cases of COVID-19 occurred at Risen Sun in June, with an outbreak at the facility reported in late July. More than 35 residents contracted the disease, along with more than 25 staff members. 9 residents died of COVID-19. "You can move one way, forward or backward. We can move forward while being mindful of those we've lost to COVID-19, Romshek said. Romshek said the facility held special invocations with Keith Ray, Vice President of Mission Integration with the Risen Sun parent company, Christian Horizons, to honor the dead. On Tuesday, Romshek and Ray Dickison, Chief Operating Officer with Christian Horizons, said the facility hasn't had a new case of COVID-19 in 5 to 6 weeks. "We wanted to say thanks and show our gratitude to staff," Dickison said. As Risen Sun hosted activities, including a dunk tank, a small parade was held to honor them as well. Our team has handled themselves with grace and professionalism, Dickinson said. In a time like this, your team has to pull together. And there are lots of great examples how our team and the need to respond to this has pulled together. St. Louis-based Christian Horizons conducts about 1,500 COVID-19 tests per week at its 14 locations, scattered across Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. At Risen Sun, the facility has worked to bring back some activities to allow more interaction among residents, Romchek said. With social distancing precautions in place, along with face coverings. Some visitors have been allowed, while the facility has used iPads and other devices to allow for interaction between residents with family and friends. We continue to look for ways to implement good ideas in that regard, Dickinson said. It's not going to replace person-to-person contacts, but it helps. Pottawatomie County Public Health and the Iowa Department of Public Health have confirmed an additional 2 COVID-19 deaths in the county. Public Health Director Matt Wyatt said Tuesday that a man and woman, both between 61 and 80 years old, died around September 9th to September 11th. There have been 38 COVID-19 deaths countywide. Around 3 p.m. Tuesday, the state COVID-19 website listed 2,006 positive cases in the county out of 20,327 tests, an increase of 5 cases over roughly 24 hours. There have been 1,635 recoveries. The county's 14-day rolling average positivity rate was 10.4%, down slightly from the day before, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. In Iowa, there were 81,303 positives out of 748,566 tests, with the positive case total increasing by 563. The state reported 12 additional deaths, with the total now 1,286. There have been 59,216 recoveries in Iowa. Iowa had 188 cases per 100,000 population over the past 7 days, sixth highest in the U.S., according to the New York Times COVID-19 tracker. Pottawatomie County was at 187 per 100,000, up slightly from Monday. Our next article is called Department Provides Details Surrounding Friday Officer-Involved Shooting Incident. It was written by Sam Pemper on September 22, 2020. More information has been released regarding the Friday incident involving a Council Bluffs police officer firing his service handgun while on scene at Walmart 3201 Manawa Center. About 7 p.m. Friday, two Bluffs police officers were at a location working a shoplifting case when a white Mazda CX-9 with stolen plates was observed, according to a news release from the department. As officers were finishing with their shoplifting incident, a white man reportedly walked up to the vehicle, got into the driver's seat. When officers approached, the man allegedly locked the vehicle's doors and started the motor. A preliminary report, the release says, indicates one officer fired his service handgun at the driver as a struggle was taking place to get the driver out of the car. The driver's window was broken out, and as the officer was reaching inside the car, the suspect reportedly put the car into gear and sped off, hitting a parked vehicle. The officer who fired his duty handgun received minor injuries to his arm and was treated at a local hospital and released, the police said. The driver of the white Mazda fled the scene, and the vehicle was subsequently located a short time later, abandoned near Interstate 29, Interstate 80 interchange. After an extensive search, the driver was not located, police said. It's unknown if he suffered any injuries. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation was called to review the actions of the officer involved in the shooting. The nonpareil attempted Monday to reach Captain Todd Wedham for additional details, but he was unavailable for comment. On Friday evening, a news release said the department won't be releasing the name of the officer who discharged his weapon until later this week. Anyone with information regarding this incident is being asked to contact detectives at 712-328-4728. Those wishing to remain anonymous can do so by calling 712-328-STOP-7867. Provided information says the department will continue investigating the alleged assault that took place on the officer and will file appropriate charges when or if the suspect is positively identified and located. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily, Nonpareil, for Wednesday, September 23rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Grace from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Our next article is an opinion article written on September 22nd, 2020, entitled Our View. Wait until 2021. He won't, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell should listen to his own words from 4 years ago and follow the precedent he set. When the Senate declined to hold a vote on the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court in 2016, we disagreed, targeting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, then head of the Judiciary Committee, for more. President Barack Obama nominated Garland to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia on March 16th of that year, almost 9 months ahead of the election. That same day, McConnell tweeted, "The American people are perfectly capable of having their say on the hashtag SCOTU nominee. So let's give them a voice." McConnell, Grassley, and others said the nomination should not move forward because it is an election year. They called it the Biden rule, based on comments that Senator Joe Biden, now the Democratic presidential nominee, made about a hypothetical nomination during election year in 1992. As we said, we disagreed at the time, with many months between the nomination and the election and an even longer time ahead of the expiration of Obama's term. But McConnell had all the power at the time and did what he wanted to, blocking Garland's nomination and setting a precedent. It's a precedent that McConnell has quickly discarded because he remains in power. On Friday, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and McConnell said that night a nominee from President Donald Trump would be voted on before Inauguration Day 2021. This time around, McConnell has changed the terms of the game, saying because the Senate and presidency is controlled by one party, the nomination will be voted on ahead of the election. Grassley echoed that sentiment late Monday. The hypocrisy, while unfortunate, is surprising. And of course, hypocrisy is not a Republican-only vice in American politics. This isn't a politician growing and changing as new information becomes available. This is about power. Always has been for McConnell. Always will be for him and his brethren. Presidents nominate justices, and Congress is to do its duty and vote on approval. When those in power choose to allow it, that is, the Constitution is a living document. When convenient, and ironclad, nothing we say will change McConnell's mind, or South Central Senator Lindsey Graham's mind, who continues his sycophantic obedience to Trump despite it, contradicting what he said during congressional hearings about the nomination issue in 2016. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, "Lindsey Graham, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination," Graham said in 2016. "The rules have changed as far as I'm concerned," Graham said Saturday, according to the Associated Press. Who changed the rules? McConnell, Grassley, and Graham. There's a chance some Republican senators will realize consistency is a reasonable request. We encourage them to reflect on what happened in 2016 and arrive at the same conclusion we have. You can't have it both ways. A precedent has been set. Follow it. This article did not have a listed author. Now we'll begin reading the obituaries for today, Wednesday, September 23rd. Our first obituary is Jeffrey Maynard. Jeffrey Austin Maynard, age 34, passed away September 19, 2020, in Council Bluffs. Born on June 6, 1986, in Council Bluffs to Stanley G. Maynard Jr. and Cindy Croson Maynard, and attended school at Lewis Central before graduating from Abraham Lincoln. Jeffrey proudly served his country in the U.S. Army Airborne Division, commonly known as Jump School, receiving Army Service Ribbon and Parachutist Badge. He is preceded in death by his father, Stanley, brother, Justin, grandparents, Cleo and Donald Croson. Senior Jeffrey is survived by his son, Stanley Maynard, and Stanley's mother, Bojana of Bellevue. Jeffrey's mother, Cindy Smirda, spelled S-M-E-D-R-A, and husband James. Sister Chloe Kleiman, all Omaha nieces and nephew, Clista, Eliza, and Henry, and other family members. Visitation Friday, 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Funeral services Saturday, 11 a.m., followed immediately by a luncheon at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Jeffrey will be laid to rest on Monday, 3 p.m. at Cedar Lawn Cemetery with military rites by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Family and friends to meet the Walnut Hill Cemetery office for cordage to Cedar Lawn. To view the funeral service streamlined, visit cutleroneal.com and click on Jeffrey's obituary. Family will direct memorials. Our next obituary is for Darla Cleveland. Darla D. Cleveland, age 81, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 20th, 2020, with her family by her side. Darla was born in Dunlap, Iowa, on February 20th, 1939, and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School. She worked as a branch bank manager and was a loving and caring person. Darla is preceded in death by her father, Frank Benson, mother and stepfather, Edith and George W. Lyons, brother Ross Benson, sisters Cleo Palmer, Bronda Noel, Joy Sowers, and Jeanette Spite. Survivors include husband Ronald E. Cleveland, daughter Kim London, and husband Daniel of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Son Ronald E. Cleveland, Rusty of Council Bluffs, daughter Joni Cleveland and spouse Kimberly Smith of Carter Lake, Iowa. Son Daniel Floyd Cleveland and wife Karen Carey of Omaha. 8 grandchildren, 1 great-grandchild, many loving nieces, nephews, cousins, family, and friends. Celebration of Darla's life, Thursday, 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Go to Cutler O'Neill website and click on Darla's obituary page for a live stream of funeral. Internment Memorial Park Ceremony. Darla's nephews, Reverend Richard F. Spite Jr. and Reverend Jeffrey Kennedy, officiants. Our next obituary is Terry Robert. Terry L. Roberts, August 3rd, 1957 to September 20th, 2020. Preceded in death by his parents, Francis and Elaine Craig Roberts, brother Barney Roberts, survived by his children, Tracy Roberts, Cindy Rasmussen, Michael Roberts, Jesse Roberts, siblings Barbara Marin and Leslie Benu, sister-in-law Teresa Roberts, 3 grandchildren. Memorial service is at Coy Konlosky Funeral Home on Thursday, September 24th, 2020 at 2 p.m. Visitation will be during the hour prior to the service. Our next obituary is from Jack Mallett. Jack S. Mallett was born on March 16th, 1926 in Baxter Springs, Kansas. He died September 20th, 2020 in Council Bluffs, Iowa. During his 44 years as a friend of Bill W., he sponsored many. An avid tennis player, he championed the first clay tennis courts in Omaha, Nebraska. In honor of his efforts, they are named the Mallett Clay Courts at Dewey Park, Omaha, Nebraska. In 2015, he was the Nebraska Tennis Association Hall of Fame honoree. He is survived by his 4 children, numerous grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Donations may be made in his memory to SPCA.org or any local animal shelter. A gathering in his memory will be held on September 26, 2020, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. For details, text or call 402-670-5883. Our last obituary for today is for Mary Webster Heine, spelled H-E-I-N-E. Mary Louanne Webster Heine, December 25, 1935 to September 21, 2020. Preceded in death by husband of 60 years, Philip Heine. Daughter, Phyllis Bruno. Parents, 1 brother, 2 sisters. Survived by children, Donald Heine, Carol Heine, Patricia Heine, Robert Heine. Son-in-law, Jerry Bruno. Grandchildren, Sunshine West, Joe Bruno, Brady Casson, Michaela Heine, Lauren Heine, special grandsons, Keontae Carr, D'Angelo Johnson, 10 great-grandchildren, 1 great-great-grandson, sister Robin Newton, numerous other relatives and friends. Private Internment, Omaha National Cemetery, 14250 Schramm Road, Omaha, Nebraska. Memorials are suggested to the VNA Hospice of Southwest Iowa. Now we'll be moving on to hear about some sports. Our first article is called Leading Off. Glasno, Rays try to win AL East. Bieber ready. This is written by the Associated Press on September 23rd, 2020. A look at what's happening around the majors today. Rays the banner. Rays right-hander Tyler Glasno gets his final tune-up for the postseason when he faces Robinson Cano and the New York Mets at Citi Field. Glasno and the playoff-bound Rays hope to make it a special night. They can clinch their first AL East title with a win or a loss by the Yankees to Toronto. I go into it with maybe a little bit more confidence than I did last year, Glasno said. Just an exciting time. Glasno is pegged to start the second game of Tampa Bay's best of three first-round playoff series next week, manager Kevin Cash said. Blake Snell is lined up for the opener, and Charlie Morton would pitch a potential Game 3. All three would have 2 extra days of rest. I feel good, Glasno said. It definitely is starting to feel more like in a rhythm. Glasno is 4-0 in his last 5 starts. Tune-up time. Cleveland ace Shane Bieber had his start pushed back a day, lining him up to open the playoffs. The Indians clinched a postseason spot Tuesday night when Jose Ramirez hit a 3-run homer with 2 outs in the 10th inning to beat the White Sox. Bieber faces AL Central leading Chicago and Lucas Giolito. The Indian star tops the majors in ERA and strikeouts and heads the race to win the AL Cy Young Award. The White Sox are half a game ahead of Minnesota in the division race. Cincinnati's Trevor Bauer is third and starts at home against the Brewers in a matchup of NL playoff contenders. Milwaukee's Corbin Burns starts Thursday at St. Louis. Clinching. The Dodgers, Braves, and Cubs can start making some playoff plans after sealing their spots in the expanded postseason field. Mookie Betts, Corey Sager, and the Dodgers earned their 8th straight NL West title and clinched the National League's top seed with a 7-2 win over Oakland. LA owns the best record in the majors at 39-16. Atlanta won its 3rd straight NL East title with an 11-1 romp over the contending Marlins. After losses and 10 straight postseason appearances, the Braves are desperate to end the drought. If you ask me, it's World Series or nothing, star outfielder Ronald Acuna Jr. said through a translator. The Cubs, who have a comfortable lead in the NL Central, earned their spot under rookie manager David Ross. Chicago missed the playoffs last year for the first time since 2014. It's very rewarding for that group in there that they've put in a lot of hard work in a unique atmosphere that has presented a lot of challenges, said Ross, who took over for Joe Maddon this season. Being away from their families, being tested, it would be really easy to get outside the rules, but they stand accountable to one another. There's so much to be proud of from my point of view. Stumbling. The Phillies have lost in 4, dropping them out of the NL playoff position. After getting a doubleheader in Washington, they'll try to regain their winning touch when Zach Eflin starts against Eric Fedde, spelled F-E-D-D-E, at Nationals Park. We've dug ourselves a hole, and we've done that before, and we've been able to fight out of it, Phillies manager Joe Girardi said. Now we have to win games and rely on other teams. Star catcher JT Realmuto returned for the first time since September 12th after missing 11 games because of a hip problem. Our next sports story is a local one titled Harlan Prevails Over Lewis Central in Hawk 10 Battle, written by Derek Noren, spelled N-O-E-H-R-E-N, on September 22nd, 2020. Harlan outlasted Lewis Central 3-1 in a back-and-forth conference showdown on Tuesday. Junior outside hitter Zofie Hendricks had a game-high 13 kills and ace and 2 blocks to lead the Cyclones to their first victory over Lewis Central since 2015, and first at Lewis Central since 2014. Anna Strohmeyer, Madison Haverman, and Maddie Bergman led Lewis Central offensively with 8, 7, and 6 kills, respectively. The victory improves Harlan to 11-14 overall and 4-1 in the tough Hawkeye 10, while the Titans fall to 5-3 overall and 2-2 in the conference. I thought our passing was much better and probably one of our better passing performance of the year, Lewis Central head coach Mike Bond said. Tuesday also marked Elsie's fifth game in a week. The torrid pace continues as the Titans are scheduled to play 6 games in 6 days, starting Thursday. This is such an unusual year. Harlan's played twice as many matches as us, so I think that helps a little bit mentally, Bond says. I think we're starting to get into a flow. I definitely see improvement and thought our serving and passing definitely improved tonight. I thought some of our hitters had a real good performance. The Titans will stay in conference but go on the road to Shenandoah on Thursday, while Harlan will play in the Nevada tournament on Saturday. Harlan, 11-4, 4-1, 25-20, 25-23. Lewis Central, 5-3, 2-2, 25-20, 21, 25-23, 16-1. Stats with the order kills, aces, blocks. Harlan, Lauren McLaughlin, 6-0-1, Ashley Hall, 2-3-0, Zofie Hendricks, 13-1-2, Delaney Wagner, 0-0-1, Macy Linen, 2-1-3, Jocelyn Cheek, 1-0-0, Macy Reichel, 1-2-0, Claire Schmitz, 8-0-6, Lauren Anderson, 6-2-2. Lewis Central, Addison Holt, 0-1-0, Reese Rochelow, 0-1-0, Grace Ruzaka, 2-0-1, Haley Erickson, 2-3-0, Maddie Bergman, 6-0-1, Anna Gallas, 3-0-0, Macy Mulder, 0-1-0, Anna Strohmeyer, 8-0-1, Elizabeth Casey, 5-0-2, Madison Haverman, 7-3-0. Our next sports story is another local one titled Lewis Central Experiments with Lineups in Dual Victory Over Atlantic, written by Derek Noren on September 23rd, 2020. The Lewis Central girls swim team defeated Atlantic 119-43 on Tuesday. Titans freshman Sydney Collins, sophomore Kylie Brown, and Warren Grave, spelled G-R-A-E-V-E, all had a productive day, winning twice individually and twice as part of a relay team. Lewis Central coach Bryce Stromberg was happy with how his team swam and used Tuesday's duel to experiment a bit with lineups. This was our fourth meet of the season, and it was an opportunity to move girls around a little, Stromberg said. It helps me going forward seeing swimmers in different races. It shows me we have depth. The Titans are back to competition on Thursday at Carroll. Lewis Central, 119. Atlantic, 43. Lewis Central individual results. 200 medley relay, 1, Sydney Collin, Kylie Brown, Elaine Morgan, Warren Grave. Time, 202.22. 200 freestyle, 1, Kylie Brown. Time, 202.39. 200 individual medley, 1, Warren Grave, 227.03. And second, Elaine Morgan, 234.26 for that time. 50 freestyle, first, Sydney Collins, 26.93. 100 meter butterfly, first, Sydney Collins, 106.70. Second, Katie Ramos, 125.51 for that time. 100 freestyle, first, Kylie Brown, 57.61. 500 freestyle, 2, Elaine Morgan, 553.39 for that time. 100 meter backstroke, 1, Hannah Steinmetz, 109.49, and 2, Abby Haas, 113.313 for that time, and the 100 meter breaststroke, 1, Warren Grave, 116.67, 2, Mia Hansen, 120.24, for that time. And finally, the 400 freestyle relay, Sydney Collins, Hannah Steinmetz, Warren Grave, Kylie Brown, time 358.24. Our next story is another baseball piece from the Associated Press, written September 23rd, 2020, entitled Miami Takes Three-Game Skid into Matchup with Atlanta. Miami Marlins versus Atlanta Braves. Pitching problems. Miami, Sixto Sanchez. Atlanta, Max Fried. Line, Braves favored by 1.5 runs. Over-under is 10 runs. Bottom line, Miami enters the matchup as losers of their last three games. The Braves are 23-15 against the NL Eastern teams. The Atlanta offense has compiled a .271 batting average as a team this season, good for second in the National League. Freddie Friedman leads the team with a mark of .347. The Marlins have gone 20-18 against division opponents. Miami is slugging .389 as a unit. Brian Anderson leads the team with a slugging percentage of .457. Top performers. Freeman leads the Braves with 34 extra base hits and is batting .347. Anderson leads the Marlins with 9 home runs and is batting .269. Injuries. Braves' Jeremy Walker, shoulder. Mike Soroka, Achilles. Phil Pfeiffer, spelled P-F-E-I-F-E-R, elbow. Tommy Malone, left elbow. Marlins, Pat Benedetti, right oblique, and that last name is spelled V-N-D-I-T-T. Steven Tarplay, right oblique. Drew Steckenrider, elbow. Mike Morin, elbow. Brian Morin, knee. Brandon LeBrant, left elbow. Eliezer Hernandez, right lat. Magnuris Sierra, right hamstring. Harold Ramirez, left hamstring. Logan Forsyth, oblique. Ison Diaz, groin. Francisco Cervelli, concussion. Our next story is entitled Martinez, Cardinals to take on Duffy, Royals, written by the Associated Press on September 23, 2020. St. Louis Cardinals, 27-25, second in the NL Central, versus Kansas City Royals, 22-33, fifth in the AL Central. Pitching problems. St. Louis, Carlos Martinez, 0-2, 8.40 ERA. Kansas City, Danny Duffy, 3-4, 5.01 ERA. Line, Cardinals favored by 1.5 runs. Over-under is 9.5 runs. Bottom line, Kansas City and St. Louis will play on Wednesday. The Royals are 11-14 in home games. Kansas City hitters have posted a team on-base percentage of .306 this season, led by Hunter Dozier with a mark of .353. The Cardinals have gone 16-14 away from home. The St. Louis pitching staff as a whole has an ERA of 3.86. Adam Wainwright leads the team with a 3.05 earned run average. Top performers, Whit Merrifield leads the Royals with 65 hits and has 31 RBIs. Pat Goldschmidt leads the Cardinals with an extra 18 extra base hits and is batting .306. Injuries, Royals, Kyle Zimmer, arm, Glenn Sparkman, right forearm, Mike Montgomery, lat strain, Ian Kennedy, calf, Matt Harvey, right lat, Foster Griffin, forearm, Franchi Cordero, right wrist. Cardinals, Ricardo Sanchez, elbow, Mike McCullough's forearm, Dakota Hudson, forearm, John Brubia, elbow, Austin Dean, right elbow. This next article is entitled Los Angeles' Walsh puts 14-game hit streak on the line against Padres, written by the Associated Press on September 23, 2020. Los Angeles, 25-31, third in the AL West, versus San Diego Padres, 34-21, second in the NL West. Pitching problems. Los Angeles, Jamie Barria, 1-0, 3.26 ERA. San Diego, Mike Clevinger, 3-2, 3.1 ERA. Line, Padres favored by 1.5 runs. Over-under is 8.5 runs. Bottom line, Jared Walsh is riding a 14-game hitting streak as Los Angeles readies to play San Diego. The Padres are 21-10 in home games. The San Diego offense has compiled a .258 batting average as a team this season, good for 7th in the league. Mandy Machado leads the team with an average of .314. The Angels are 9-16 in road games. Los Angeles has hit 79 home runs with this season, 8th in the American League. Mike Trout leads the team with 16, averaging 1 every 11.9 at-bats. Top performers, Madacho leads the Padres with 16 home runs and is batting .314. Trout leads the Angels with 16 home runs and is slugging .607. Injuries, Padres Kirby Yates, right elbow. Trey Wingenter, elbow. Javi Guerrera, personal. Anderson Espinoza, elbow. Jose Castillo, lat. Louis Campusano, left hand. Angels, Justin Anderson, elbow. Franklin Barreto, undisclosed. And our final sports story for today is entitled Webb Expected to Start for San Francisco Against Colorado, again from the Associated Press, written on September 23rd, 2020. Colorado Rockies, 24-30, fourth in the NL West, versus San Francisco Giants, 27-27, third in the NL West. San Francisco, pitching problems. Colorado, Ryan Castellani, 1-3, 5.53 ERA. San Francisco, Logan Webb, 2-4, 5.73 ERA. Line, Giants favored by 1.5 runs, over-under is 8.5 runs. Bottom line, San Francisco and Colorado will square off on Wednesday. The Giants are 16-18 against NL West teams. San Francisco ranks fourth in the majors, hitting with a .266 batting average. Donovan Solano leads the team with an average of .339. The Rockies are 15-19 in division games. The Colorado offense has compiled a .255 batting average as a team this season. Charlie Blackmon leads the team with a mark of .302. Top performers, Alec Dickerson leads the Giants with 10 home runs and has 27 RBIs. Trevor Story leads the Rockies with 26 extra base hits and is batting .295. Injuries, Giants, Jeff Samardzija, spelled Samardzija, right shoulder, Reyes Moronta, shoulder, Trevor Gott, right elbow, Tyler Beede, spelled B-E-E-D-E, elbow, Mike Yastrzemski, calf, Joey Rickard, elbow, Chadwick Trump, shoulder, Aramis Garcia, right hip, Rockies, Scott Oberg, blood clots, Peter Landberg, elbow, Joe Harvey, elbow, John Gray, shoulder, Brendan Rodgers, shoulder, Chris Owings, hamstring, Nolan Arenado, spelled A-R-E-N-A-D-O, left shoulder. The Associated Press created this story using technology provided by DataScribe and data from Sport Radar. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Grace from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.